Good evening, folks. This is The Weird Part, and I am your host, Vincent Treewell. Tonight will be a solo episode, so it will probably be a little shorter. The solo ones tend to be briefer, just because you don't have the dynamic of having somebody to kind of bounce questions off and such. Just to get into a little bit of stuff regarding the show, the Great June Upgrade continues. The Weird Part is going to be coming out a lot more frequently, and hopefully new and improved, and the Patreon will become an actual functioning Patreon with multiple tiers, and there will be significant bonus content that will make it well worth your while to become a Patreon. We will have guests. We've been having guests, but we will continue to have guests. But we'd also like to be able to get out and do some on-location broadcasts. If you would like to be a guest on the show, by all means, contact me at vincenttreewell.gmail.com. I will definitely get back to you. I do admit to being a chronic procrastinator, and that's why I haven't gotten back to some people, and that's probably why I don't have a guest for tonight, but be that as it may, I still think you'll find this interesting. But yes, if I've told you that I want to have you on as a guest on the show, I mean it, and we're going to make that happen, and I'm going to be getting in contact with a number of people in the coming days. Also, if you are an experiencer, you've had an experience that you want to talk about, by all means, contact me. I definitely want to hear from you, and you can come on the show and talk about it. Even if you're not an experiencer, I think most people, to some degree, kind of are somewhere in their life, but if you are not, but you just have theories or ideas about how things might work, by all means, drop me an email, vincenttreewell@gmail.com, and we'll, at a minimum, consider it, you know. So yes, that's just some housekeeping. Tonight is going to be a discussion of a book, kind of a book report, you might say, and it's a very interesting volume that I read first back in high school. It was written before I was born. And it provides some real insights, I think, into things that are taking place in our country today. Now, the book that I'm going to be discussing is 1968's One More Victim, The Life and Death of an American Jewish Nazi, by A.M. Rosenthal and Arthur Gelb. And it discusses the sad life of a man named Dan Burroughs, who was exactly all those things. He was born in New York City into an Orthodox Jewish family and later became a member of the American Nazi Party. And, you know, spoiler alert for a book that was written over 50 years ago, it doesn't have a happy ending. Burroughs killed himself at the age of 28. While a leader in the New York chapter of the Ku Klux Klan, and when it was exposed in the New York Times that he was born Jewish, and he took his own life, and this goes into how does a person get into that type of thing? What attracted him into this kind of a movement? And I think it has a lot of relevance in today's time. I did not think when I first read this book in high school that when I was in my 50s, we'd still be talking about Nazis. I thought that they would only, that there would be Nazis. I thought that we would only be discussing them in a historical sense because that would just completely have passed away. Well, you know, it hasn't. Okay, and it's very much something that's in the news frequently, for terrible reasons, and Burroughs is a real case study in how someone gets drawn into this world, and You know, what are their motivations? What is the lure? It's also a fascinating study of how the extreme right works, the factions and infighting amongst people who are fascist and beyond, and it has a lot of relevance for our time. It's also good that if you watch the news, it can lead to despair. I watch the news, I like to know what's going on, but it can seem that we're living in cataclysmic times. It's good to have some historical perspective that shows that these things didn't start yesterday. They didn't start 10 years ago. The American Nazi Party was founded by George Lincoln Rockwell in 1956. So in other words, the war was barely over. And yes, he thought he was going to be America's Hitler. And he, having the opportunity, certainly would have been. And Burroughs became a follower of his. And it goes into what did he see in that? In that movement and in that person that he found attractive. So it's absolutely fascinating book, very well written, very detailed, and that's kind of what I want to go over tonight. So Daniel Burroughs was born March 5th, 1937, and took his own life on Halloween Day, October 31st, 1965. He was born in New York City to an Orthodox Jewish family and had a relatively normal, stable childhood within that community. He appears to have been the type of person who's either 1,000% into something or 0% into something. He, when he was growing up, attended the Torah classes, and the rabbi who taught him considered that someday he might become a rabbi. He seemed very interested and learned his material, learned Hebrew, studied the Torah, and really appeared very committed to that. At some point in his teens, he had gone through the bar mitzvah and, you know, had become a full member of the synagogue. At some point, apparently in his teens, he abruptly loses interest and just goes from 100 to 0 and doesn't want to be involved with Judaism at all. At that point, he doesn't seem to have been interested in anti-Semitism. He just seems completely done with being Jewish. Of course, he's in high school, isn't it? He went to public school and everybody knows he's Jewish, but he just ceased activity with that community. It is not, and this is a fairly brief book. The paperback version that I have is only 176 pages, so it is not exhaustive on the life of Daniel Burroughs or anything else. It is, however, very informative, and I find it quite fascinating, because it shows a lot of things that are present in our current society have been there for quite some time. You can see a lot of Dan Burroughs in a lot of people, for example, that were at the January 6th insurrection. He's that type of person. He is drawn consistently to very extreme ideas, and drawn to a series of great leaders in his life. While still in high school, he joins the National Guard, and immediately out of high school, joins the active duty army. He has a brief military career, which he actually becomes a paratrooper, and is initially successful. Ironically, he is sent to enforce the desegregation orders in Little Rock, Arkansas. He later claimed to have been horribly offended by this, but that doesn't appear to have been the case at the time, where he seemed like he was actually excited to be getting where the action is and being a soldier. During his time in the Army, and perhaps even preceding that, he becomes very interested, you might say obsessed, with Nazi imagery, and he begins to collect pictures and clippings and bric-a-brac that has to do with Nazism. And just to riff a little bit, if you've ever been to a gun show, especially, I think they've kind of cleaned this up more recently. I haven't been to one since the pandemic, but growing up in the 70s and 80s, if you went to a gun show, there was just, to be blunt, a shitload of Nazi memorabilia. Armbands and medals and chest stuff, daggers, things that had at one time belonged to actual Nazis. He loved stuff like that. He was always collecting that. And that, remember, he's in a world where World War II is a very recent memory for a lot of people. Obviously the Holocaust as well. But particularly in the Army, I mean, a lot of the, like, his commanders would have actually fought the Nazis. So that was a time when, yeah, they took that very seriously. And when he started to talk to people about his interests in Nazi stuff, he was almost universally shunned. It was not cool at all. And that, I think, goes to show how our society has gradually started to forget that the youngest veteran of World War II would be in his 90s now. The very youngest. It wasn't like that then. It was a fresh memory, fresher than Vietnam is today. As fresh as the first Gulf War is today, or more so. As time marches on, people tend to forget, society tends to forget, how bad things really were. And I think that explains some of the rise of neo-Nazism. And I don't even like the term neo, because other than the fact that the war is over and Hitler's dead, the people on social media being Nazis and posting swastikas and things like that, they're not neo anything, they're just freaking Nazis. That's, you know, my take on it for what it's worth. But I think it's important to remember that this is not a new phenomenon. Yeah, American Nazi Party, founded in 1956. You know, this has been around. And interestingly, so to kind of keep things in somewhat chronological order, Burroughs becomes openly Nazi while he's in the Army and commits multiple suicide attempts, which aren't taken realistically. It doesn't seem like he really wanted to die. It seemed like he just wanted to get out of the Army. And so the Army was like, we really don't need this guy. That's fine. They gave him a discharge based on inability to adapt to military service. And he was let go from the Army. There is a huge number of people today in hate groups, in radical political militia type organizations who have that kind of entry level military experience, but it didn't go very well, and then they get out and try to enter something that's like the military, to kind of replicate that, the good parts of that experience for them. And that's what he does. He gets out and fairly soon thereafter joins the American Nazi Party, which at the time was, they lived together in a barracks, quote unquote, and it was a house, but they wore uniforms, and it was as much a cult as it was a political movement. And they followed George Lincoln Rockwell, who had been a Navy officer in World War II, and had dedicated himself to trying to be America's Hitler. And he didn't live in the barracks. He had his own home. But there were a floating number of 1 to 2 dozen, maybe it tops out at like 30, young men, a kind of revolving door of people with a lot of problems, who lived in this barracks and participated in the American Nazi Party. And that's where Burroughs ends up, fairly quickly after his discharge. It's interesting to note that Burroughs distinguished himself in that organization by being so vocal and so violently full of hate that he made the other Nazis uncomfortable. Which is, you know, kind of hard to do. But he would say things in public that they'd prefer not only be said in private. And he just took his extremism and dialed it up to 11. So he's a member of the American Nazi Party who's freaking out other members by how extreme his views are. Okay, so that's just an interesting side note that was his personality. He did everything 0 or 110%, not anything in between. And I think there's a certain personality type that is drawn to organizations, a lot of different organizations. It could be something completely different. Like, I would say the same type of personality under different conditions would be drawn to, say, PETA, you know, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or, you know, Greenpeace, or something else. It's that all-or-nothing mentality that seems to lead to fanaticism, and he definitely had that. So, one thing that I got from this book that is of interest to me, and hopefully to somebody else, is that the phenomena of trolling did not begin with the internet. What the American Nazi Party did day to day was trolling. They would go and march around in these Nazi uniforms, and carry Nazi flags and carry signs saying really offensive things, and try to get arrested or try to start an incident. And they would frequently call the police and even the FBI and tell them in advance, this is what we're going to be doing. They wanted the publicity. They would frequently call, I am not making this up, the Anti-Defamation League of Brene Brith, the, you know, Jewish organization that is against hate crimes, anti-Semitism, that whole thing, and tell them we're going to be at this place at this time to hope to draw counter-protesters. It was a game of trolling, and that was their primary activity. They didn't have enough members to really do anything, like, physically that was going to be effective at all towards reaching any of their goals, but they wanted to create a lot of stir and get a lot of attention. And they were doing trolling in the early 60s, you know. That, you know, is something that goes on constantly in today's politics, but it is nothing new. And it's important to keep that in mind. When you look at the world, you look at politics and social media, that there is,
the book of Ecclesiastes says,
there is nothing new under the sun. And this didn't start with the internet, didn't start with Facebook. It's been around. There's also a fascinating section in this book which discusses the limits of free speech and how frequently the American Nazi Party went to various civil liberties groups, including the ACLU, to be defended on free speech grounds. And it is indeed a thorny, knotty question. This back and forth over what is the legal limits of what you can say and have it be just words and opinions, and when it becomes actual incitement to riot, and when it becomes fighting words, and when it becomes provocation that might justify somebody doing something to you, or becomes disorderly conduct where you can be arrested for it, percolated throughout the 60s and 70s, and resulted, well after this book is written, in the 1977 Supreme Court case of the National Socialist Party of America versus Village of Skokie, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago that had, at the time, and I believe it still does, a large Jewish population. And the Nazis wanted to march through Skokie, spreading their message, dressed in Nazi uniforms, waving swastika flags. And this went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, no, that was political speech, and that is protected by the First Amendment. And that's a major, it's still a landmark case. And that's still the precedent right now. That's how things like the Unite the Right rally in Charleston, South Carolina, are able to occur. It's a difficult question of where does free speech end and action begin. But that is what it is right now. Other countries are not like that. In many democratic republics, you cannot display certain symbols. Presenting a swastika in Germany is a criminal offense. Canada is a lot tighter on that stuff than America is. It's just food for thought, just some commentary. But they discuss that at some length, that the American Nazis were quick to go to very liberal attorneys and seek representation to protect their right to say terrible things. I'm not going to take a position here and now. This isn't a political show. But I had a really good professor in college who talked about this very issue and the First Amendment. And his way of explaining it was, the First Amendment to the Constitution is not there to protect your right to send Mother's Day cards. It's to protect speech that people would find so vile as to be illegal. And that's important to keep in mind. So I'll just let that hang there for the moment. Just as an FYI, there is a ton of armchair psychologizing in this armchair psychology in this book. I can't verify how much of that is accurate. A lot of it's a matter of opinion. The authors discuss a lot of their speculation. I'd have to call it speculation because they're not psychologists, they're not psychiatrists. You know, they're just kind of expressing their opinions on Dan Burroughs' psychology. And they point out that he apparently didn't ever have a close relationship with his father and seemed to be seeking a father figure his whole life. They kind of posit that his disaffection with
Judaism came after the rabbi that he was very close with, that he looked up to and kind of idolized, moved to a different congregation. And young Burroughs took this as a betrayal and then, like, completely turned his back. If that's how it is, then I turn my back on Judaism, type of thing. Then he sought a father figure in officers and sergeants in the army, but didn't really connect with anybody. And then he sought out George Lincoln Rockwell as a father figure, to whom he was obsequiously ready to be a servant. And, you know, Rockwell kind of took him for granted, but that was, he was always seeking a strong older man that he could be a son to, type of thing. That's their speculation. He later went on to similarly idealize a different neo-Nazi leader in the National Renaissance Party, a neo-Nazi group that still exists. And, I don't know, that's interesting. Possibly that's the connection of why he was into this stuff. I don't know. But it's definitely of its time. It's, you know, kind of the Dr. Phil answer for why did somebody become a neo-Nazi. It's also interesting, and this is very currently relevant, apparently Dan Burroughs never had a girlfriend until almost the end of his life. Like, maybe 6 months before he kills himself, he meets this very, very racist white woman, and they become a couple. And they share a common interest in military insignias, the bric-a-brac that comes with the military. Burroughs always loved uniforms and medals and patches and badges and insignia. He really liked that stuff. And she was really into it too. And I'm sure that his opening line to her didn't involve being Jewish. But so he did have a girlfriend for the first time in his life at 28. Unfortunately for him at least, before the end. And then I guess it's well worth exposing. We'll get there in just a moment. So bluntly put, what I was trying to say is Dan Burroughs was an incel. He did have apparently fairly frequent encounters with sex workers, but as far as a relationship, no, that the first 28 years of his life, that did not happen. So, the first 27, that did not happen. So, is that a factor? Well, there is a personality type. There is a psychological profile, you might say, that goes with being in these kind of groups. And there's not a whole lot of ladies' men in the, radical right. In hate groups, it tends to not be a lot of guys in steady relationships or actively dating. How is that connected? I mean, feel free to draw your own conclusions, but it definitely seems to be a thing. And it was definitely the case for Dan Burroughs. There is certainly one episode that's detailed in this book that I can't not mention because, well, it just kind of speaks for itself. And that was the time that Dan Burroughs and George Lincoln Rockwell went to a Nation of Islam meeting hosted by Malcolm X. Yes, that actually happened. It happened on June 25th, 1961, at the Uline Arena in Washington. And I'm going to quote a little bit from the book. I am fully in concert with their program, and I have the highest respect for Mr. Elijah Muhammad, Rockwell announced. Rockwell said the only real difference between himself and the black Muslims is a matter of territory. They want a chunk of America, and I prefer that they go to Africa. A bit later, he said he might possibly promise Elijah Muhammad Mexico if he wanted it, although the border problem might require some thought. Yeah,
we'll just let that hang there. So Malcolm X does his presentation and called for donations of $100, dropped to $50, and got down to $20. At that point, this is quoting from the book, Rockwell grimly pulled out a $20 bill and gave it to a Fruit of Islam man to be sent to Malcolm. When Malcolm asked who had donated it, a Rockwell trooper shouted George Lincoln Rockwell, and the reporters and cameramen swarmed around the commander. At Malcolm's suggestion, Rockwell stood to applause, and Malcolm said, I bet that's the most applause you've ever received in all your life. Rockwell was not enormously amused, but managed a thin smile. Yes, that actually occurred. Now, this was Malcolm X pre-going on the Hajj and going to Mecca and having kind of a conversion experience where he changed a lot of his racial views upon encountering numerous white Muslims and, you know, took a very different view of things. This was the 1961 version of Malcolm X, and at that point he was very much under the wing of Elijah Muhammad, who totally endorsed George Lincoln Rockwell. In an issue of a Rockwell publication called The Stormtrooper, he reproduced a comment from Elijah in the April 1962 issue of Muhammad Speaks. Yes, that's the same newspaper that you can currently pick up at certain locations, and is the newspaper of the Nation of Islam. Mr. Rockwell, American Nazi Party, has spoken well. He has lived up to his name. He's not asking you and me to follow him. He has endorsed the stand for self that you and I are taking. Why should you not applaud? No other white people want you to do such a thing. His own people will hurt him or try to hurt him. You heard what he said. Just because they have taken a stand to see you be separated to get justice and freedom. And I can tell you that the mutual admiration between American Nazi groups and the most extreme elements of the Nation of Islam has continued all the way to, at a minimum, if it doesn't continue today, I am unaware of it, but at least to the time of William Pierce, the head of the National Alliance, a neo-Nazi group that I believe still exists, and the last person that Tim McVeigh called on the phone before the bomb went off. And in Pierce's literature, the Nation of Islam is portrayed in a very positive light. Just leave that hang there as food for further thought and research. That's not a condemnation of the Nation of Islam. I personally know people who feel this had a very positive effect in their life. But there is a history there that does exist. So anyway, I couldn't not mention that absolutely surreal moment when American Nazis are welcomed by Malcolm X. And yeah, that actually happened. So in November 5th, 1961, Burroughs ultimately has a falling out with George Lincoln Rockwell, and he and a friend leave the compound and don't come back. They go on to start their own magazine called Kill, which is described as Kill Magazine, dedicated to the annihilation of the enemies of white people. Dan Burroughs, editor, signed the lead article, The Importance of Killing. Okay, yeah. They somehow managed to be more extreme than the American Nazi Party. And their magazine doesn't really go anywhere, but it is kind of a labor of hate, you might say. So yes, he's broken at that point with Rockwell,
and gone out on his own, but he doesn't last long on his own. So Burroughs and a couple of his friends not only form Kill Magazine, but they form something called the American National Party, which was headquartered in a one-room wooden shanty at, I'm quoting from the book, at 190th Street, in a section of Queens called Hollis, which I can't resist pointing out is where the guys in Run DMC came from years later, but yeah, what it is. And I'd like to just quote a little bit at length. Fringe right parties like the American National Party spring up and wither almost overnight. Most of these parties have the same core of members, and often these members belong to several simultaneously, and swap membership cards as children swap marbles. The parties, while they last, exist largely in the imagination of the members, bolstered by little that is tangible except letterheads on the stationery, and then disappear with the first intra-party feud. The kid with the ball and bat walks out and the baseball game is over. These groups are, however, to some minor interest to students of the political right, and to psychologists, and of considerably more than passing interest to the police. Their major political interest clinically is their symbiotic or parasitic relationship to the left-wing groups. Little parties, clubs really, like the American National Party, have no real programs beyond a jargonized racist platform, and one reads almost exactly like another. They have almost no money. Burroughs paid for most of the $50 an issue it cost to have the four issues of Kill printed in a downtown New York photo offset plant, and no members whose names and backgrounds in themselves can win attention from press or radio. To get attention, the American National Party, during its brief existence, had to feed off of activities of the left, or off of liberals and intellectuals. The left is identified with causes or controversies, Vietnam, Cuba, military services, that do command press attention. The intellectuals produce plays or movies that are noticed by the press. And that's a thing that still goes on today. There's many groups that form and then dissolve and then reform as something else. And it's really kind of all the same people moving around. Now, social media, the internet, have greatly amplified this. But again, it's nothing new. It's nothing that hasn't been going on for decades and is what it is. So it's good to have some context. There's another section of this book that I feel has significant relevance to today, and that's begins with chapter 12. The American National Party did not attract much press attention, but it did fascinate the special anti-subversive unit of the Police Department of New York City. The squad knew the names of every member of the party, and spot checks were kept on each. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, more became involved than a simple security watch designed to keep an eye on the nuts when important foreigners were in town. The detectives assigned to the squad came to feel that there was a particular kind of danger in these groups. Not to foreign delegates particularly, but to the city itself. This is how one of them put that. These young toughs live and breathe the atmosphere of violence. That's all they talk about, getting this guy or blowing up this or that. A lot of them have guns, and it is as if they are making love to them. They are not for anything, but they are against an awful lot of things and of people. They get all excited, you might say aroused, by the civil rights movement. It got them all worked up. Yeah, that's a quote from a 1960s NYPD detective. If that doesn't exactly describe a ton of people in this country right now, well, it does, yeah. And this is nothing new. This has been ongoing. And what we're going to get to is that Burroughs and Rockwell and damn near everybody else in this kind of movement was an informant. They're all informants. Okay, that's a blanket statement. I'm sure there are some who are not. But being an informant is epidemic in the far right. I don't have a source for that. I really wish I did for the specific thing I'm about to say. But there was a time, I believe it was in the 70s, it may have been the 80s, when the feds were looking at raiding a unit of the Ku Klux Klan, and the problem with raiding it was that every single member was either an undercover agent or an informant for some government agency. Yeah, the entire group, everybody was either undercover or was reporting in to state, federal, local cops at some point. That's a thing that goes on. And that just, again, provides some context. And a lot of these guys love being informants. They go on to discuss how Burroughs loved to be an informant and go down and talk to the detectives and tell them everything about other Nazis, because he got to be treated like a bigwig and talked to by the cops in a respectful way. And that was, they didn't like pay him any money or anything. He just told them what they wanted to know. That is just a repeating classic part of the American extreme right. So to pick up on page 122, the American National Party lasted for just about a year. Burroughs and Patler had a falling out about the picketing of a racial integration rally in Englewood, New Jersey. Patler was arrested and sent to jail for 10 days. He started a hunger strike in jail and was angry when Burroughs had not given enough moral support. Patler also felt that Burroughs had not shown enough enthusiasm about picketing, and was particularly annoyed at Burroughs' decision to watch a ball game on TV rather than picket Eleanor Roosevelt's funeral in Poughkeepsie on November 19, 1962. Patler and a friend did picket, and Patler carried a sign, "Ship her stinking corpse back to Moscow." He was arrested and sentenced to 90 days. When he was released on a habeas corpus filed by the American Civil Liberties Union, he decided he had had enough of Burroughs and that Rockwell was his leader after all. When he told his wife that he was returning to Rockwell, she decided that she had had enough, and they were divorced. Patler again became a Rockwell lieutenant. For a while, Burroughs was without a leader or a club. I'm just going to skip forward just a bit. And they talk about Burroughs' interest in the book Imperium by Francis Parker Yaki, which is still a very important text in the extreme racist right. Let me skip on to 124. But without a party, without a club, without a leader, and without uniforms, Burroughs felt lost and rudderless, and sometimes used to say so to his friends in Yorkville. He attended meetings of a half dozen splinter groups, and then selected one to join, the National Renaissance Party. Although the NRP was not much larger than the other fringe groups, about 20 or 30 members, and almost no reputation outside the fringes, Burroughs found it. To go on, although the... For one thing, the party had been in existence for years, and that made it practically a historical institution. For another, its founder and leader, James H. Medill, was like Rockwell, an older man. He was 37 and could be looked up to, but at the same time, he had the virtue of hating Rockwell. The party supplied its members with uniforms. It had a permanent headquarters at Medill's Manhattan apartment at 10 West 90th Street. And for Burroughs, possibly the strongest appeal of all, the leader had a mother who lived with him, a mother who heartily endorsed her son's activities. Mrs. Medill was a tall, gray-haired woman, embodying all the forceful Germanic qualities that Burroughs adored. She was as rabidly and outspokenly anti-Semitic as her son. So there's an incident in July of 1963 that leads to Burroughs going to jail. There is a protest going on by the Congress for Racial Equality they were protesting discriminatory hiring practices by White Castle.
Yes, that White Castle.
It's still around?
Yes. In 1963, they were apparently not hiring black people, and there were going to be some protests of that situation. The radical right decided they were going to counter-protest. And I quote, "The clear goal was provocation. The civil rights picketers carried signs demanding jobs. The counter-marchers carried signs which include a lot of racial slurs I'm not going to quote here. But yeah, on the night of July 13th, 1963, there was a meeting at Middall's home to prepare a counter-demonstration at the White Castle. Middall was there, his mother, Burroughs, and four other men. Party member Edward Cassidy, 19, known at headquarters as Middall's faithful dog, and like Burroughs, a major in the security echelon, 21-year-old John Corrigan, 26-year-old Peter Krause, and 36-year-old Paul Joachim, none of them official members of the NRP, all of them freelance sympathizers with its aims. Group met to prepare racial leaflets to distribute at the diner. Later that night, Cassidy, Corrigan, Krause, and Joachim left Middall's house and drove in a truck to the neighborhood of the diner. Their plan was to shout insults at the core protesters in case of physical counterattack to fall back to the truck for protection and weapons. At Buckner Boulevard, they were joined by 26-year-old Anthony Wells, a former member of Rockwell's group, and 22-year-old Ian Lair, an ex-member of the defunct racist group called the Fighting American Nationalists. In the diner, Joachim flung the leaflets prepared at Middall's house into the ranks of the picketing corps members. "This will let you know we are not with you," he shouted. When that got no reply, another member of the group yelled, "Let's get out of here, it smells like a zoo," and another used some racial slurs I will not repeat. That brought a response. Once enraged corps picketer began wrestling with Joachim. Police, who had been keeping an eye on the picketers, broke up the fight, and Middall's band retreated to their truck, which is surrounded by an angry mob. With police help, they managed to drive free. Just skipping ahead a bit. Leaving Corrigan in the truck, Joachim and Cassidy entered the police station and told the desk sergeant they wanted to make a complaint. They referred to Detective William Rooney, who rumored seeing both of them in the diner. They told Detective Rooney that they had been assaulted by corps members and their truck had been damaged. Detective Rooney, and I'll just leave that hanging there, that here are people who went to commit a hate crime and are trying to file a police report. Again, sometimes things change and sometimes they stay the same. Yes. Detective Rooney went out to inspect the truck, in which Corrigan was still waiting, and found a bit more than the complainants had wanted to exhibit. He found racist leaflets in an attaché case. Inside the case were a fully loaded .22 caliber revolver and more racist leaflets. Also in the truck was a pellet gun with a box of bullets, box of pellets, loaded tear gas weapons, a crossbow loaded with a steel-tipped arrow, a butcher knife, a switchblade, a straight razor, two masks, a long-handled axe, and two gun holsters. The police arrested Corrigan, Joachim, Cassidy, and after Cassidy had obligingly supplied their home addresses, rounded up Krause, Lair, and Wells. Later that day, Burroughs appeared at Middall's house in a state of great agitation. He just heard a news bulletin. "All our fellows have been arrested," he cried. Before Middall had a chance to turn on the radio to confirm the news, police in civilian clothes knocked on the door and arrested them both. Although Burroughs, when questioned, said he had no part in the attack on corps members, knew nothing about it, and any planned violence by the NRP. He'd been busy stapling literature together during the meeting, he said, and paid no attention to the discussion. So Burroughs goes to jail. He doesn't like going to jail. Nobody does, but particularly, he was kind of obsessed with not being in jail for probably obvious reasons.
So Burroughs and several co-defendants go on trial, and as the book describes it, the trial droned on without much excitement. The reporter sat up straight and began to take notes when Detective Thomas Marino took the stand to testify about picking up Ian Lair at his home. Detective Marino testified that in the apartment he saw a Jewish calendar. In the car riding to the police station, Martino said he asked Lair if he were Jewish, and the answer was yes. Martino, over the objection of Lair's attorney, Perez Rosenthal, testified that Lair had told him he did not belong to the NRP, but did belong to the American Nazi Party. I asked him at the time, I said, if you're a Jewish, how can you belong to an organization like this? And he said, well, the members don't know that I'm Jewish. I said, well, what do you... I said, you know what they stand for. He said, yes. I said, the annihilation of the Jews and other minority groups. He said, that's right. I said, do you still belong to it? He said, yes. You see, I am a coward. I belong to nothing and have accomplished nothing in my life. And I belong to this just to belong and to be able to do something. He said, now I feel like somebody when I belong to this group.
I'll just let that hang there. The trial goes completely off the rails. Because apparently several members of the American Nazi Party were actually Jewish. And lest that be thought of as a one-off, it's not. In today's radical right, you'd be surprised who's involved. Well, look at who is the guy from the Proud Boys, the president of the Proud Boys, actually. And I don't want to mess up his name, so I'm not going to mention it, but you know who he is. He is a black and Hispanic person who happens to be the president of a white supremacist group. That's not a new thing. That's been around. Someone leaked a list several years ago of prominent white supremacists who either are of Jewish nationality or are married to Jewish women or are married to Asian women, which seems to kind of undercut your whole, you're a white supremacist, right? Well, yeah, that's a thing. And that's a thing that's been going on for a long time. So yes, so Burroughs is far from alone in his kind of way of life. During the testimony, Burroughs stared impassively at Lair. Occasionally he doodled but kept busy staring. All through the trial, except for this bit of testimony, Burroughs looked curiously around the courtroom and seemed to be enjoying himself. Several people noticed him particularly. He seems to have such a swagger when he walked. He seemed so full of confidence and exuberance. There was another Burroughs who sat in the Bronx courtroom, and this is the quotation, during the trial. His name was Robert Burroughs, and although he had not participated in the White Castle Diner fracas, he was a devoted member of the National Resistance Party, the National Renaissance Party, and greatly interested in the fate of his fellow members. Born in 1937, Robert Burroughs used to talk about the fact that they had the same name and explored the possibility that they might be related. But neither explored it very thoroughly. Daniel, because of course he was concealing his parents' Jewishness, and Robert, because he too had something to conceal. Later, after the name Burroughs was in headlines across the country, Robert Burroughs admitted his own father was Jewish. He was criticized at first by the National Renaissance Party for having concealed that this interesting fact. His credentials as a devout racist and faithful servitor of Madol were accepted, and he was allowed to continue to serve. As a matter of fact, he became something of a drawing card and a publicity getter. Robert Burroughs was a tense man with a compulsion to talk. He was bar mitzvah, but, he had said, it was against his will. His mother was a pure-blooded Aryan, and he was not biologically a Jew. Those are his statements. They're sure as hell not mine. My father was Jewish, but he saw the viewpoint of the National Renaissance Party.
he once told an interviewer. My father was an American patriot. My father always advocated America first. Let me just close the quote. Just leave America first, hang there. Google it. Open quote. And my father saw what Zionism was doing to this country. It was ruinous and disastrous. My father believed in the supremacy of the white race. My father always spoke in favor of the supremacy of the white race. My father always ridiculed the Jews. You see the Jews. He's always preaching the Jews must control the world. The Jews are so fanatical. It's dedication. That in order to control the world, they're going to see the rest of the world destroyed so that they can control it. That's how fanatical and paranoid the Jewish nation is. My father always opposed this. My father was always an American first. And I found the Jewish language and Jewish culture so alien to me that I could not assimilate to the culture, the religion, the philosophy into my intellectual mainstream. Yeah, so that's Robert Gross for you in a nutshell. The jury went out at 3 p.m. on June 9th. It returned at 4:55 p.m. the next day. All the defendants except Corrigan were found guilty of conspiracy. All except Corrigan and Lehrer were found guilty of riot. Corrigan and Lehrer were formally guilty of unlawful assembly. Burroughs, Madol, Cassidy, and Joaquin were found guilty of possessing firearms.
Yeah, very different time.
Anyway, all except Burroughs, Kerrigan, and Lehrer were found guilty of possessing dangerous instruments with the intent to use them against others. Lehrer's attorney made an emotional appeal for his client. Somewhere, and this is, they put this in quotes, somewhere along the line, something went wrong.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
The judge sentenced Madol to 1 to 2 years in state prison, the maximum sentence for the indictment to riot without participation in the riot. The same sentence was handed down for Burroughs. In passing, and this is Dan Burroughs, in passing sentence, the judge said, not the least regrettable aspect of this whole incident is the fact that defendants Madol and Burroughs, the more sophisticated members of the group, did not hesitate to recruit for their malevolent purposes young men who they succeeded in injecting with their own virus of hate.
Yeah, that's ripped from the headlines of today. Like, go to a news feed today. That's exactly what's still going on.
In the case of Lehrer, convicted of 3 misdemeanors, the court said the defendant was entitled to sympathy. He is a confused, inadequate, insecure individual.
Yeah, thanks, Judge.
And confinement would destroy the possibility of rehabilitating him to normal life. The court suspended sentence on Lehrer and placed him on probation for 3 years. On July 24, 1964, Burroughs, Madol, and Anthony Wells were sent to Sing Sing, the state penitentiary, at O Sing Sing. The other convicted men were sent to other prisons.
So they sent all 3 of these neo-Nazis to prison together. That just seems like really bad planning. You'd think the first thing you'd want to do is split them up, but 1964, that's how they did things.
To skip ahead slightly, Burroughs might have grown sulky if the martyrdom had been protracted. He did not stay at Sing Sing even long enough to complete the 2-week orientation period. He was released 10 days after his arrival, on August 4th, on a certificate of reasonable doubt, because his case was being appealed, and Madol was released about a week later. Burroughs' release was secured with a bail of $7,500. That's $7,500 in 1964 money, which is a lot, okay? Which was posted by his uncle, a brother of Esther Burroughs. So yes, the irony is, think that the family he had turned his back on got him out of prison. Yes. And they go on page 133. There was an emptiness, a flatness, an almost unbearable sense of futility in Burroughs' life after the White Castle trial and Sing Sing, and for a long while he did not know why. There was certainly plenty for him to do. He was making a name for himself in the fringe world. not only in the United States, but in the British and German and Australian and French fascists, who read his little newsletter, The International Nazi Fascist. Yes, he published a newsletter called The International Nazi Fascist. Yeah. And he made contact with a lot of people that had actually done things in World War II era. And if you've ever seen the movie or read the story by Stephen King, Apt Pupil, this is totally that, okay? He connected with real Nazis who were not neo-anything. They were like actual Nazis that did the shit. And he connected with quite a few of them. And they were always ready to receive fan mail. Yeah. So he knew people who had literally done this stuff. And that was a big part of his life. So to pick up on page 134, they go on to say, in 1965, Burroughs found what he was looking for, an organization with roots. People, a group with real people all over the country, not just letterheads. He found it through a combination of a scratchy old movie, a one-eyed racist from Pennsylvania, and a meeting in Bear, Delaware. The movie was Birth of a Nation, made in 1915 from the book The Klansman, and referred to by the Klan as part of its recruiting drive. Burroughs saw it in a revival at the Museum of Modern Art. Yeah, the irony is thick. And afterward, he talked about it endlessly. It was just like the beginning of the Nazi movement, he said. The same ideals, real organization. He said gloomily that something had happened to the Klan that had gone dead. Roy Frankhauser changed his mind. Frankhauser was a short, lean, neat, dark-haired man with a wild smile. He had lost his left eye in a barroom brawl. And, okay, close quote. If you've ever seen the movie Birth of a Nation, it's worse than you expect. If you haven't seen it, it's worse than you expect. I saw it once for a films class and felt like I witnessed a hate crime. It's a really bad movie, which was made in 1915 by A-list actors and director, and yeah, it was very mainstream, and President Woodrow Wilson praised it because he was a total fucking racist, but yes, that happened. So apparently, this movie 100 years later, well, I guess it'd be then, only 50 years later, had a great effect on Burroughs. And he decided that he was going to be in the Klan. And at that time, again, we're talking over 50 years ago, the Klan and the Nazis were not on the same page. There was huge distrust between them. And because the Klan considered themselves to be real Americans, they considered the Nazis to be the enemy. And their whole grievances revolved around the Civil War, and essentially they hated black people, but they hated Jews too, but they weren't interested in Jews. The Nazis hated black people, but they weren't really interested in them. They were obsessively anti-Semitic. And those two groups really didn't rub elbows that well in his time, in 1965. Actually took a class about this in college, and apparently the Nazification of the Klan happened around the 70s and 80s, and the two came to be on the same page as they are now. They're essentially one and the same. But that was not always the case. And when Burroughs is dealing with the Klan, they're trying to kind of cool up with that Nazi shit, because, you know, people see swastikas, they get the wrong impression. And yeah, I know how that sounds, but that was the actual reality at the time. And of course, frequent listeners probably will recognize the name Roy Frankhauser, because we'll get to that in just a little minute. But yeah, he actually becomes very close with Frankhauser, and is living at Frankhauser's house when he takes his own life.
So to pick up on 135, on July 28th, 1965, Frankhauser invited Burroughs to accompany him to a Klan meeting in Bear, Delaware. Burroughs had never attended a meeting like that. He lived in a world where 10 or 15 people got together for cell meetings, a world of shouting at street corners to attract passers-by, of feeding off crowds gathered by the enemy. He looked around the field at Bear and saw crowds of men and women who were like him in their hatred of Jews and blacks, thousands of people, 13,000 by Frankhauser's account. Burroughs grabbed Frankhauser and said, "This is it. This is the way to capture the American imagination. Mass movement. This is the reality of the mass movement." "Yes," Frankhauser agreed. The Klan was the answer, but suddenly Burroughs was dejected. "I can't join them," he told Frankhauser. "Why?" "Well, you know the code and everything." What Burroughs explained, what Frankhauser listened to, was with complete seriousness, was that Burroughs, as an Odinist who did not believe in Christ, but in the war gods of the Norse people, could not fulfill the Klan's membership requirement of faith in Christianity. Frankhauser insisted there was a way out. "Do you like Christ and everything?" Burroughs thought that over. "Yes, I dig him and everything," he said. "I understand him. I understand the Christian idea, and I'm with it. I'm still with the Christian West." Frankhauser said, "Well, I think God and the Klan would understand this. You can join, and I'll swear by you." Frankhauser approached Robert K. Shelton, the Imperial Wizard, and told him about Burroughs. There was bad blood between Rockwell and the KKK, and Shelton had rejected other members of the American Nazi Party. He decided to make an exception for Burroughs, as he had quit Rockwell. "Roy, will you swear by this man?" Shelton asked. "I'll swear by Dan Burroughs as I would my own life," Frankhauser said. "This man is 100%. "I'm going in on this my life," Burroughs declared. When he learned the Klan would accept him, "I'll do my best, Mr. Shelton. If you let me in, I'll fight until I'm dead." Burroughs joined the Klan that day and entered the happiest period of his life. First, there was the richness of uniforms. There was the regulation white gown and hood that he got when he joined. At meetings in the South, he would sometimes wear the uniform of a Klan security guard. Black boots, belt, flashlight for direction of traffic. Occasionally, he would give little speeches in the South at Klan meetings, worded as simply as possible, quote-unquote, not to go over their heads, mostly about how the North stood with the South, and they were in this fight against mongrelization together. Just, that's their words, not mine.
And almost immediately, Burroughs became Grand Dragon of New York and had a distinctive uniform to wear, the scarlet gown befitting his rank. Burroughs was promoted for two reasons. There were not many hard workers to choose from, and Frankhauser and others believed that what the Klan needed was an intellectual patina from people like Burroughs. A Klan leader said once to Burroughs, "You got some good points, and you put that on paper and bring it in, and we're going to try to work on it. We're going to have to put more men on it, because we're not used to this. We're country folk around here, and we can still use your ideas." Flattered beyond anything he had experienced before, Burroughs embraced Shelton as his new leader. "Here's a man I can follow." Burroughs became Grand Dragon. He was also King Kleagle, organizer for New York State. He was in charge of two rival claverns and became adept in bridging the hatred between them. The Uptown Clavern held its meetings in a fourth-floor apartment at 1762 First Avenue in Yorkville. 20 to 30 people would show up for a meeting. Newcomers were welcome, but cautiously. They might be undercover agents. Burroughs followed the prescribed procedure for inviting potential members to his meetings. When a letter from a would-be joiner in his office was passed to him, usually by the National Office of the United Klans of America, Burroughs would reply, "We thank you for your interest in the organization. Every Saturday, unless the security guard attachment is on a mission, we hold a Klavern meeting." Here Burroughs gave the Yorkville address. "When you knock on the door, give the password action now. This is not only a temporary password for applicants. This is only a password for temporary password for applicants. This is not the KKK password. You will only receive the KKK password after you've been investigated, qualified for membership, and received the oath."
So yes, he gets, as usual, 110% into what he's doing, in this case, the plan. And he starts, you know, he's living with, you know, Frankhauser, who is very notorious, and we're going to get to that in just a moment, but yes, that's where he's living. He's 1,000% in the Ku Klux Klan. Well, that's why this era is different than our current era. There was this thing called the House Un-American Activities Committee. It was part of Congress. And they didn't own, they're the group notorious for blacklisting people who had associations with the Communist Party. But they didn't just go after communists. They also went after Nazis, and they also went after the Klan. And I'm just going to throw this out there that that might not have been a totally wrong idea, okay? Maybe Congress should look into some of this stuff. That's my opinion, and I stand by it. But yes, HUAC was very interested in the United Klans of America. And they decided that they were going to call the leadership, subpoena the leadership, under a congressional subpoena, to appear before Congress and answer questions about their activities. And that is kind of how the story comes to an end. So yes, HUAC, we'll get there. Give me one moment. Just to give a little background on Roy Frankhauser, he had, shall we say, a very checkered past. The feds asserted he'd been arrested 142 times. He was convicted in 1975 of selling dynamite to a group that later killed a guy. He said that he did so because he was an informant for the ATF. The ATF denied that, but I'll just leave hang out there how questionable that denial is, because informing in the extreme right is just epidemic, and the feds love that, so we'll just leave that there. He got in a lot of trouble throughout his life, and ultimately, he's been involved. He died a few years, he died about 15 years ago in 06, and he was involved with essentially every extreme right-wing group that there was. He was, for a while, as a youth, a member of the American Nazi Party. He was a big deal in the Klan, but he was in everything else, too. The U.S. States' Rights Party, which is shockingly violent for what sounds like a more moderate group. And no, he was involved in everything. And he was involved with Lyndon LaRouche. He was head of security for Lyndon LaRouche for a while, and that got him a 3-year stretch in prison. Well, the dynamite only got him probation, but being involved with Lyndon LaRouche got him a 3-year stretch in the federal pen for credit card fraud. But yes, he had a lot of criminal cases, and some of them very weird, including one where he got off on self-defense for stabbing a Ku Klux Klan security guard, which is the ultimate white-on-white violence. But yes, that happened. He was a very disturbed and dangerous person. But he was involved with everything from way back into the 2000s. And that's who Dan Burroughs was living with when he took his own life. The circumstances of that come down to the House Un-American Affairs Committee subpoenas the top leadership of the United Klans of America to report to Congress and answer questions. Frankhauser showed up and just kept taking the fifth over and over and over. But in reporting the story, and Burroughs was served with a federal warrant to appear before Congress and answer questions. And in doing the research for that news story, the New York Times found out, wait, this guy was born an Orthodox Jew? What? And they reported that in the New York Times. And that led directly to Burroughs taking his own life. And he went to the house that he was sharing with Frankhauser and shot himself to death. And, you know, that's kind of the end of the story. But, you know, many white supremacists came forward to say that this guy was okay. He was really one of us. Which is just weird in its own way. And that kind of draws a conclusion. We're going to wrap this up here. But let me just say that one more victim, the life and death of an American Jewish Nazi, by A.M. Rosenthal and Arthur Gelb, written in 1967 and published in 1968. Excellent book, foundational text, tells you how a lot of things work. Now, I must issue a trigger warning that it was written in 67. They don't censor any of the racial slurs. If you're going to read this, be prepared to read it in its time. But it's an excellent book, and while rather brief, it delivers a ton of valuable information. In any event, thank you for listening. This has been The Weird Part. I'm Vincent Truewell. Thank you, and good night.